Okay, let's unpack this then. When you hear the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species, you might just imagine, a big catalog of animals kind of on the brink. But our deep dive today, we're going to peel back the layers a bit and reveal why this list is arguably the most powerful, but also nuanced tool in global conservation. Our mission here is to show you how it cuts through all the noise and is actually changing the world, like way beyond just scientific journals.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, its roots, they trace back to the Red Beta books from the 1960s, but those were, well, let's say somewhat subjective. The real pivotal moment, the actual game changer that made it this globally respected scientific thing, that was 1994.
1994. Okay.
Yeah. That's when they brought in objective quantitative criteria, and that really built its modern credibility. Yeah.
That move to quantitative criteria, that sounds like a really fundamental shift. How did that impact its influence, its ability to drive action? Because it's fascinating how it seems to manage this dual role, being like incredibly rigorous science, but also acting as this powerful call to action.
That's the genius of it, really. It translates this super complex ecological data into those clear, urgent labels, like critically endangered. Labels that just cut through and demand attention. The science informs the advocacy, basically.
Right.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, you'll see how species actually get on this list. There are 9 categories in total, but the ones that really matter for this are the 3 threatened ones: vulnerable, endangered, and critically endangered.
Yeah.
And a species doesn't land there based on, someone's opinion. It's about hitting very specific, measurable benchmarks. Think about it like, a species losing a huge chunk of its population, maybe its habitat shrinking drastically, or its actual numbers falling below a critical point. Any one of these distinct quantifiable triggers, just one, can put it on the list. It makes it undeniably data-driven.
That sounds incredibly robust, But I can imagine just collecting the data itself must be a massive hurdle sometimes. What happens when the data just isn't there? Or, it's patchy, incomplete.
That brings us to a really critical challenge. The data-deficient category. And you need to understand, this isn't like a safe status. It's basically a formal declaration of, scientific ignorance. We just don't know enough.
Ignorance, okay.
And it creates this dangerous conservation blind spot. Because species, without clear data, they often get overlooked for funding, for action. It leads to this vicious cycle. And studies actually show that many species classified this way, they are in fact threatened, which suggests the whole crisis is likely even worse than the main list tells us.
Wow. That's a really powerful picture of the science and its challenges. But okay, beyond the categories and the data, how does the Red List actually translate into, real-world change? What are the practical implications on the ground?
Well, it's huge. The Red List is really a cornerstone of international environmental law. It directly influences big agreements like CITES. That's the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, which regulates trade.
Right, CITES.
Yeah,
sure.
And also the broader Convention on Biological Diversity. But perhaps its most profound recent expansion, and this is really interesting, is into the private sector.
The private sector, how so?
It's now getting integrated into corporate ESG criteria. That's environmental, social, and governance. So what this means is, for businesses, for investors, a threatened species listed on the Red List isn't just some ethical issue anymore. It's becoming a material financial risk.
A financial risk. Okay, that changes the game.
Exactly. It shifts the whole conservation argument from being purely ethical, which is important, of course, but adds this really pragmatic economic imperative.
It sounds like a double-edged sword then. Incredibly powerful, yes, but it must have inherent limitations too. You mentioned biases, like the charismatic megafauna effect, where, let's be honest, pandas get way more airtime than some obscure but maybe critical fungus.
Absolutely. That's a known bias.
And there's also that Noah's Ark dilemma I've heard about. The idea that by focusing so intensely on saving individual species, we might sort of inadvertently neglect the health of the entire ecosystems they rely on. How does an organization like the IUCN grapple with critiques like that?
Those are absolutely critical points, yeah. And the Red List team isn't ignoring them. It's actually evolving because it understands these limitations. While the Red List is, excellent at its core job preventing individual extinctions, it's maybe less adept at measuring a species' ecological function, like what does it do in its habitat, or measuring its recovery once the immediate threat is managed. That's precisely why the IUCN isn't static. It's innovating.
Okay, so it's not standing still. Where does this leave us then regarding its effectiveness? What's the bigger picture unfolding here?
Well, the Red List is continuously evolving, adding new tools to its toolkit. For instance, there's now the Red List of Ecosystems, which does what it sounds like. It assesses the risk of entire ecosystem collapse, not just species.
Ecosystems themselves, okay.
And then there's the green status of species. This is really important. It measures recovery. It's the other side of the coin from just looking at extinction risk. How well are things bouncing back? Plus, you've got cutting-edge tech like AI and eDNA, that's environmental DNA from soil or water samples, starting to speed up the whole assessment process quite significantly.
That sounds much more holistic. So for you, listening right now, what's the ultimate takeaway from all this complexity?
I think the real insight is to think about biodiversity assessment kind of like managing a diverse investment portfolio. You wouldn't just focus on the failing stocks, right? So don't just look at the threatened species on the red list. That's identifying risk, yes. But also track those showing recovery with the green status and understand the health of the entire market, if you will, with the red list of ecosystems. This holistic portfolio approach gives you the clearest picture.
A portfolio approach. I like that.
Okay. And remember this. Championing targeted funding specifically for those data deficient species, that's crucial, filling those knowledge gaps. Because ultimately, it's not just about saving individual species in isolation, it's about strategically investing in understanding and then restoring our planet's overall health for the long game.